Your voice is very similar to Tom Franken.
I've been told that, yeah. And some people say I sound like Paul Harvey.
Good day.
And now the rest of the news.
No, you don't sound like Paul Harvey.
I do. In fact, he fired me as his announcer because I sounded so much like him that people thought he was doing his own announcing. Of course, it was a few years ago.
Maybe the inflections, though.
That was 1958.
Well,
I've matured and gotten older and older and uglier since then.
No, well, the voice is. I guess there's a resemblance, Paul Harvey. That's really very close to Tom Franklin. And really incredible.
And his father, Ben.
Yeah.
And his sister, Aretha. I knew them all.
Yeah. Where do you hang out in Michigan?
Not anymore. I hang out there a couple of weeks of summer. Yeah, we still have the place there, although I no longer own it. It's always available to me. The very nice folks in Chicago who bought it from my father in 1949 gave us the opportunity to come back there during what's known as Get Together Week, the second week of August each year, when the Abbott Magic Company invites everybody in the world of magic to come there and just enjoy a week of shows and lectures. And it's a convention without being a convention. It's a fun time.
The Blackstone Book of Magic and Illusion is very interesting because it covers so many aspects of magic. You can trace the history of magic in it.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at a memoir about your father and his history, tracing the things that you have done as a person, as a magician. Tells you how to do illusions. What did you leave out?
Well, we didn't tell how the illusions are done. It tells you how to perform an illusion, but it doesn't tell you how to do an illusion.
Oh,
and there's a big difference in that.
Shucks.
And we do that for a very good reason. If people's interest become piqued to the point where they are interested, and they are willing, voluntarily, to give up the ability and the sense of wonderment of magic, then we'll teach them how it's done. But you have to be willing to give up that sense of wonderment that, as an audience member, you now enjoy watching magic. If it's done well, you enjoy that.
You really got off to an early start, didn't you? You assisted your father when you had a very young age. Tell me what that was like for you.
Well, it wasn't a sort of a deliberate or even an assigned responsibility. Being along with the show, as I was when I was not in boarding school, I would have certain little responsibilities to take care of. Sometimes I would handle the animals. Sometimes I would move the trunks or work the sewing machine to repair the scenery or occasionally even hook up the chorus girls, the buttons and zippers and things. And I was young enough at that point that it didn't make any difference. As years went by, those were the things, the priorities changed. And then in my later years, as the time came when I was about ready to take over the show, I was given the responsibility of being not only on stage assistant, but stage manager. Occasionally, I would work the front of the house, where I would handle the box office responsibilities. I was the company manager, handling the logistics of moving that 90 tons of apparatus. It took a couple of 90-foot baggage cars to move the show and the people. That's in the day and age when railroads still moved on schedule, and you knew which town the train was going to. Nowadays, the shows move usually by truck. We use 3 45-foot semis to carry the show.
Three
of them, right. That's a big show. Yeah. 54 people involved in the performance, 28 of whom go with us as part of the traveling company, and the rest picked up locally that are musicians, stagehands, wardrobe handlers, ushers, box office people.
Like a mini circus.
It is.
Yeah.
Even a maxi circus.
Do you remember your first appearance on the stage with your father and doing something?
Specifically,
in front of an audience?
No, I do not remember it as an event. I've heard the story told many times because my dad used to love to tell the fact that one day mother discovered that the young lady who was my babysitter did not come to the theater. They were doing four or five a day. An early show had been put in, and she, my mother's, decided that it would be safer for me to go into the illusion and be part of the show than leave me in the dressing room by myself, where I'd no doubt get into all the makeup and the cold cream. So at a few months of age, I guess I was 6-7 months of age at the time, mother took me into this illusion, and when just she was supposed to appear, not only did she, but I did also. And she had quite a sense of humor. She had painted a small mustache and a beard on my little 6-7 month old face, and my father just roared when he saw me to come out, and I was laughing and giggling and responding to him, and the audience was laughing, and with the bright lights and the laughter and the applause that happened, my dad said that was the beginning, because I chased both of them for years after.
You still have the beard and the mustache, too.
Still have the beard and the mustache. This one isn't painted on.
Did you, as a very young kid, have some inkling that your father was a very special, very different person? You know, most kids' fathers, they go to an office to work or to a factory, or they drive a bus or something like that. But here's Blackstone the Magician, and you're his kid.
No, I didn't have that sense. Dad did magic in order to bring home the bacon. I mean, it's just what we did. I didn't know any different. I didn't know any better. It was just what the family did. My Uncle Pete, my dad's brother, was an integral part of the show. Millie, his wife, my Aunt Millie, was probably my closest friend in those early days, because while my father and mother were my parents, they were always out front. They were the ones doing the show. And Pete and Millie and the other members of the show that traveled were my brothers and sisters and my friends. And we didn't think of it as being something special. In fact, in later years, I've realized that really my dad did me kind of a disservice by allowing me to know all of that aspect of magic, all of the how, long before I understood the why. Because I couldn't understand why people were so amazed by what he was doing. I saw how it was done. I was backstage. I saw the apparatus coming off the truck and being assembled in each town and being put up, and little devices that were not seen by the audience that I knew were there. And that's how it was done. And it wasn't until many, many years later when I guess about 19, 20 years old, I was invited to take an all-expense-paid olive drab tour to Korea. And while I was over there, I began seeing magic performed by other people, by other cultural sources. And these magicians in Korea and Japan did magic totally differently. And I didn't know and I didn't understand how it was being done. And for the first time, I began to enjoy the wonderment of it. I then could capture that sense, that empathy of what an audience must have felt in the hundreds and hundreds of performances that I had watched from backstage or in the orchestra pit or overhead in the gridiron or wherever I happened to be as a young man. So that was when I began to understand it as an art. I had great background in the science of magic, but I was probably in my early 20s before I began to understand that it was also an art. And it was the beginning of that period and the studying of the theatrical arts and putting that together with the science of the special effects of magic, which, in fact, what an illusionist is an actor who presents special effects in an entertaining way. We call them mystery, we call them magic, but in fact what it is an entertainment form that I then began to understand was much more than what it appeared to be on the surface.
It was never your intention, then, that you would carry out a family tradition of magic.
No. Well, there was no family tradition. My father was the first Blackstone. I mean, it didn't become
uncle,
a family
uncle
tradition.
Pete.
Well, not really. You see, my Uncle Pete, while he and my father were the closest that two brothers could possibly be for their entire lives, Pete was always the technician of the magic act. He was always the one who created the comedy relief in the early days. They were born in Chicago. My dad in 1885, my Uncle Pete in late 1886. And Pete became the clown of the family. And while my dad would do straight magic, Pete, later as a white-faced sort of commedia dell'arte type clown, would burlesque the material that he did. In the period about 1904 and 5, my father and one of his other boyhood friends, a chap named Bobby Landis, performed as Martini and Maximilian. They loved the names. They created an act. Well, Bobby Landis went on to do other things. And this spot of the white-faced clown was open, and Pete said, well, why don't you let me try it, rather than just be backstage? So Pete and Harry Bouton started the Bouton Brothers with straight and crooked magic. And all during that time, and the period before World War I, they would play the major locations. In fact, the first place they ever played was in St. Paul. And they were the act on a bill with a new motion picture called The Great Train Robbery. And that was sort of the beginning of it. And they began to see things in this film and vaudeville period that they knew that they liked. Well, they continued on the Sullivan and Considine circuit and worked through there. In fact, they made lifelong friendships out of the people that they met on those bills. There was a group from England that was performing with them at that time called the Carnot Troupe. Now, the Carnot Troupe used to do a performance called Nights in an English Music Hall. And there were three young gentlemen, Englishmen, that were to become lifelong friends with my dad and Pete. One of them was named Charles Chaplin. One was named Stan Laurel. The other was named Ted Banks. Well, we all know what happened to Chaplin and Laurel. Ted Banks became my father's closest friend and his stage manager, and was with him for the rest of his life, of Ted's life. In fact, in 1942, when the theater that they were working on caught on fire, Ted worked so hard with Pete and the other people to get all of the apparatus out of the show while my father was moving the audience outside that he literally worked himself to death and died the following day. And those friendships and the people that we met, that was family. That was the way it all happened. In fact, Ted's wife, Sally, was my governess and took care of me in all of those years when Mom and Dad were out on the road and I was at home in school. Sally would take care of me, and after Ted died, she remained on for the rest of her life there in our little home in Michigan.
You have wonderful photographs in your book, including some posters showing your father with a variety of different names. Somewhere along the line, he adopted the name Blackstone. How did that come about?
Well, after many different names, first using his real name of Harry Boughton, B-O-U-G-H-T-O-N, he changed that to Leroy Boughton for no particular reason. He just liked the name Leroy. Then he changed it to Harry Bouton, B-O-U-T-O-N, because he thought the French sound to it was so much better. Well, that became the name he and Pete used. And he picked up all other kinds of names, like C. Porter Norton and Mr. Quick. And finally, one day, there was a man who made posters who said that he had some unclaimed magic posters with the name Frederick the Great. And would he, Harry, like to buy these? He could go out for a couple of seasons with this, and the posters would be beautiful colored paper, and he could buy it for 5 cents on the dollar. Well, that was a good deal. So he didn't have a reputation under one name, so why not have no reputation under another? So he went out as Frederick the Great. His timing was impeccable. A few months later, we were at war with Kaiser Wilhelm, First World War. Well, as you know your history, Kaiser Wilhelm's father was Friedrich der Grosse, Frederick the Great. Well, the anti-Germanic feeling all through the Midwest at that particular time in 1914 really kept my dad and Pete and the others in the company from making a living with the name. And they were in Wapakoneta, Ohio. And my dad's first wife, Inez, and Pete decided that they had to come up with a name that they could use so that they could continue being booked. So they were walking along from the theater back to the hotel after a performance one night, and my dad looked up and he says, "We need to find a name that's as easy to read as that sign up there." And the sign said, "Blackstone Cigars." And Pete said, "No, I don't think Cigar the Magician would be a good name." And they all laughed. And he said, "Blackstone." He says, "That's got a good name. It's got an English name, nice sound to it. And I think here in the Midwest, I think that'll be a good name." So they thought about doing that, and they wired back to their agent. And they said, "What about the name Blackstone? Can you hire us if we use that name?" And he wrote back, "I've got 20 weeks' work for you as Blackstone the Magician." So on the 7th of January of that year, my father did his final performance as Frederick the Great. And the following day in Tiffin, Ohio, Blackstone the Magician did his first performance.
And the rest is history.
And, well, at least the rest is magical history.
Magical history. Your father was a contemporary of Harry Houdini, but
yes.
All was not well between Houdini and Blackstone, was it?
All was not well between Houdini and anybody who came in contact with him that was any kind of a threat. Houdini, while being a supreme egotist, was a kind of an insecure guy as a performer, from what I understand. And while he was a great performer and perhaps the greatest publicist between P.T. Barnum and Mike Todd, Houdini would never allow anyone to steal his thunder or what he thought was his thunder. So he had, in fact, a clause in his performance contract that said neither Thurston nor Blackstone can work any theater that the great Houdini works for 3 months before or 3 months after. So, in the days before the restraint of trade laws came along, my dad could not work those major theaters, and he got a little upset by it. And they had a few confrontations. One of them ended up in Houdini bringing my father up on charges before the National Variety Artists, the NVA, which was the then only union protecting the performers, and said that Blackstone had stolen his underwater box escape. And my father said, "I did not, you horse thief." He says, "You stole mine." And Houdini said, "Prove it." And he did. He brought newspaper articles dated to the time before Houdini had ever performed the underwater box escape, proving that he, Harry Bouton, had performed that underwater or overboard trunk escape. And then my father, in his way, said, "Not only that, but I've still got the trunk and I'll show it to you." And he went to his warehouse, and lo and behold, the trunk was missing. Never did find the trunk again. About 1931, which was about 5 years after Houdini died, Joe Dunninger, the great mentalist, went to Houdini's widow and offered to buy certain of the pieces of apparatus and memorabilia that had belonged to Houdini, and said to Bess, "Have you got a box or something around that I can put this stuff in? I'll carry it back to my place." And Bess said, "Sure, down in the basement there are a bunch of boxes and trunks. Pick any one you want." So he found this very nice metal trunk in the basement, which, and when he opened it, he noticed that there was a little spot on the bottom of it that was like a trap door. It had been used as an underwater box escape trunk. And when he opened up the secret panel, he discovered in there a plaque that said, "Made by Pete for Harry Bouton." Now, nobody to this day knows how that trunk got into Houdini's basement.
Well, magicians can play all sorts of magic, but just think of the ramifications of that. What about the possibility that Houdini was actually using Blackstone's box?
Yes. Well, you see, actually, Houdini never used the trunk. Houdini always worked with not a metal trunk that he carried from town to town, but being a rather penurious gentleman, he would telegraph ahead and challenge a local lumber yard to make the wooden box that he escaped from, and that way he didn't have to carry the box from town to town. So, no, he never actually used the trunk, but he didn't want anybody else to use it either, apparently.
As we can tell by your voice, your natural gift, at one point you got into radio and somehow got out. But it really wasn't until after your father's death that you decided to pick up the cudgel and become a magician. Is that true?
Pretty much so. Yeah, I was in broadcasting. I was in a little broadcast operation in Austin, Texas, that was owned by the then Senate Majority Leader, who shall remain nameless, and his wife, Lady Bird. And I learned more about the art of deception working for Lyndon Johnson than I ever did working with my dad. And I mean that in a very positive way. I'm not trying to be snide or anything like that. I'm quite serious. The art of deception I'm speaking of, not the misuse of the art of deception. He was a great gentleman for being able to have you watch the left hand while the right hand does the dirty work. Now, misdirection and the art of deception, of course, are the keys to successful magic. And having been a salesman, a politician, broadcasting and journalism, what better training ground could I possibly have for the art of deception? So I went into magic. And that was 1968, 69. I was working for the television portion of this network at that time in Television City as the associate producer and later the producer of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. And one day, one of your executives suggested that we all pack our bags and leave because we wouldn't submit our shows for censorship. And Tommy Smothers said we'd rather not submit them for censorship, so we were all out of work. And at that particular time, we were doing a film at Warner Brothers called Get to Know Your Rabbit. It was Brian De Palma's first Hollywood film. And Tommy played the part of a tap-dancing magician. I was the technical director on the show, created the magic for it, worked with Orson Welles, and also played a small part in the film. And Tommy became so enamored of that character that he suggested that we play this Donald Beeman character against a real magician in the Christmas show that we were taking into Caesar's Palace. Well, I was the real magician that he chose, and the reviews were so favorable about not just the performances, but magic per se, that the reviewer for Variety, a fellow named Forrest Duke, said, "We ought to see more magic like that. Haven't seen it in years, and young Blackstone ought to get back in there and try to keep up the name."
You were using the name Harry Blackstone Jr.
That's the only name I've ever had. Mm-hmm. You see, I was born after my father changed his name.
Oh, he changed it legally.
He changed it legally in 1927.
So Blackstone is your legal name.
It's my legal name. So I had no other name to use. I could have used the name Bill Cosby, but people would have become suspicious.
You couldn't use Tommy Smothers.
No.
John Smothers. It doesn't sound right somehow. Right.
No, but in fact, the Smothers Brothers and I did an act that was called Tom, Dick, and Harry. And it was a lot of fun with it. So anyway, the responses, the reviews were so good that Tommy came up to me after we got these wonderful reviews, and he said, Harry, he said, you ought to get into magic full-time. He said, look at the reviews. And I said, Tommy, I can't afford it. I said, magic is an expensive art. He said, what would it cost you? I said, I have no idea. Probably $50,000 to put an act together. Costumes and props and music and scenery and all that. And he said, we're going to be here another couple of weeks. He says, when we finish here, I'll arrange for you to get the money from a man that I know that's a banker in Los Angeles. Tommy went to Los Angeles, to the first Los Angeles bank, and a gentleman there gave me a loan, which I found out later had been co-signed by Tommy Smothers, so that I could get the funds to put together that act. And Tommy's manager, Ken Cragen, got me a booking at Harrah's Club at Lake Tahoe, and 11 months later, I was in the magic business full-time, and that was the beginning of 1970, and I've been in it ever since.
Your father appeared in vaudeville, and you now have an act that has three vans taking all of your props and all the people. It's 50-odd people involved in this.
Right.
Does a magician have a difficult time trying to find a place in which to practice his art?
Oh, absolutely. In the day and age when my father was out on the road in the golden age of magic, so-called, there were 2,500 to 3,000 locations in the United States alone where we could perform. Nowadays, there are probably less than 200. But with 200 locations, theaters, nightclubs, cabarets, that sort of thing, the fairs, we can keep it going. I did the best year I've ever had in my life last year. And this year really looks like it's going to be even better.
Probably a larger...
Excuse me.
It's all right. This is taped and I edited, so it's not... It's not like the Today Show. Have you been on the Today Show yet?
Mm-hmm. This morning.
This morning? How'd it go?
It went great. It'll air on June 3rd. We taped it after the regular part of the performance, and Brian Gumbel is an easy mark, shall we say. He loves magic. We do that.
I would assume that the places that you perform are larger than the small theaters that your father came across when he was traveling.
Well, we play all-size theaters. We sometimes will do 2 and 3 performances in a day in order to have the number of people come through to, you know, make the expenses work. In the day and age when he was at his prime, the minimum-size theater would be 1,500 to 2,000 seats. Those were the vaudeville theaters. Nowadays, it's very difficult to find a theater of that size. There are none in the Broadway district in New York. I think the biggest theater here is 1,900 seats, right about. And it doesn't matter that there are different size locations, because you can adapt a magic show, which tends to be rather modular, in order to fit the size facility and the kind of audience that you have. I'll tell you an interesting thing that happened one time that'll give you an idea of how important those early days were. When I was first beginning to perform on television and in magic, I was invited one summer to be on the Kraft Summer Music Hall. Eddie Arnold was the host on the show. And my father helped me put together a couple of things, and he was very pleased with this 7 or 8 minute routine that I had done. I came back to him after the Saturday night taping over at the Brooklyn Color Studios, and he said, Harry Jr., how'd you do last night? I said, I did pretty good. And I said, we'll find out tomorrow how many people saw it and what they thought of it. Well, the overnights came in the next day, and we found that there were 29 million people that saw me perform that night. And my dad was absolutely flabbergasted. He said, you realize, Harry Jr., more people saw you perform last night than saw me work in a lifetime. Now, that's part one of that story. I work in many, many places. I've been in about 200 cities in the last 12 months. Each city I go into, someone will come up to me and they'll say, I saw your dad in the so-and-so theater in whatever. You fill in the name of the theater and the name of the town, and they've probably seen him work there. I went up on stage. I held that birdcage that he would make vanish. I was the child that received the rabbit in the show. I was intrigued by magic to the point where I am now an amateur magician or a professional magician. And this happens town after town, day after day, week after week. I can't imagine that there could have been less than 10,000 people that have told me that in the last few years. As we sit here at this very moment, no one has ever said to me that they saw me perform on the Kraft Music Hall.
You know, it's strange. We sometimes forget what we saw on television the night before.
That's right.
It's true. Are there any little Blackstone juniors who might be carrying on the tradition of Blackstone in your family?
Well, I have four daughters. And my youngest, age five, well, she's the scamp of the family. And, of course, a five-year-old can get away with literally anything. I have two teenagers, one that's 16 and one that's 18. They're in high school. In fact, my 18-year-old will be graduating from high school next week.
Has she conned you to perform at her high school auditorium yet?
I did that last year. I did that last year, in fact, helped their class raise some money for their junior-senior activities. And then my 21-year-old is currently attending the California Institute of the Arts, where she's studying professional theater from a technical standpoint. So my four daughters, Cynthia, Adrian, Tracy, and Bellamy, are in their own ways, each of them, at this point, ready to do something in the world of magic. My 21-year-old, I think, will be my technical director if she ever becomes part of the show, and that'll be her decision. My 18-year-old is a mathematical genius. She'll be the one that handles the box office, because not a penny will get away from her. Now, the 16-year-old, Tracy, I'm not sure. She'll either be a nuclear physicist or a stripper, because she's quite capable of being successful at either one of them, and probably the five-year-old will be the magician, because every time there are chores to do at the house, she disappears. So she's learning the trade.
Well, Harry Blackstone, Jr., it's a delight talking to you. You really have a stage presence, all right. The years of experience has shown that you know how to handle a microphone. And
well, thank you.
I really appreciate you coming in and spending this time chatting with me.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I would like to do one thing. Have you ever been sawed in half?
Not recently.
Do you know that BookBeat could then be done in stereo?
Yeah, yeah.
Would you like to give it a shot?
On that note, thank you very much for coming in and talking.
My pleasure. Thank you, Don.